regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Let me move that microphone a little bit closer there. How you doing? Thanks very much for being a part of the program today. Of course, my name is Cam Edwards. Glad that you're with us on the show. As I mentioned yesterday, I'm going companyless today. Actually, you're the one keeping me company because I had this like 8-hour window when the washer repairman was supposed to show up. So may impact our weekly live chat with Hot Airs Ed Morrissey and myself. Fingers crossed it does not. But we will be back to having a guest tomorrow. And I'm going to go ahead and let the cat out of the bag. We are scheduled on Monday. Well, I'm not sure if this is going to actually air on Monday or Tuesday. It might be airing next Tuesday, just based on the timing of this interview. But we are scheduled to speak next week with Assistant Attorney General Harmy Dillon, head of the DOJ Civil Rights Division and, of course, the Second Amendment section. DOJ filing suit against the U.S. Virgin Islands government on Tuesday over a lot of egregious violations of our right to keep and bear arms relating to somebody keeping a firearm in the home. You do have to obtain a license in the Virgin Islands, and apparently it routinely takes more than a year to obtain a license. In order to get a license, you have to tell the government why you want a gun, which sounds awfully May issue to me, right? You are also required to have a safe in the home. There are specifications for that safe. And once you become a gun owner, the police get to come into your home, yeah, and inspect that safe and inspect your firearms on a yearly basis. So I said yesterday when I was writing about this, I don't have the Virgin Islands on my DOJ Second Amendment section bingo card, but given the egregious abuses outlined in the DOJ's initial complaint, I think that's a very good call for the DOJ to make. So again, we'll be talking, hopefully you'll hear this interview Monday or Tuesday of next week with Harmy Dillon, Assistant Attorney General at the DOJ. And I'm very pleased that the Assistant Attorney General is going to join us here on the program. Today, though, we're going to be talking about this a new report, actually an updated report by Everytown for Gun Safety. You're going to see a lot of headlines about this, so we've got to get into the details here. This is one example of the headline. This is from a NPR affiliate, I believe, in North Carolina. Thousands of guns are found at crime scenes. What do they tell us? Well, Everytown wants us to believe that these guns that are, by the way, not all found at crime scenes, first of all, that these guns that are traced show that the biggest gun makers in the country are knowingly and willfully arming violent criminals. Yeah, that's their assertion. Not backed up by the facts in the slightest, of course, but why would we expect Everytown to tell the truth? So yeah, this is from a WUNC in North Carolina. And they actually start by saying the number of 3D printed guns recovered at crime scenes has increased dramatically in recent years, according to a report released Wednesday by the gun control advocacy group Everytown for Gun Safety. I'll give WUNC credit for actually calling Everytown a gun control group and not, you know, oh, it's just a gun safety group. They're just in favor of common sense gun laws. They're not about anybody's Second Amendment rights. No, they're a gun control group. And this dramatic expansion of the number of 3D printed guns recovered, Everytown says it increased by 1,000% between 2020 and 2024 in 20 cities that they looked at. That sounds really bad, doesn't it? We're talking about in 2024 a total of 325 home-built firearms that were recovered by police in these 20 cities. And by the way, in some cities, the numbers have actually gone down, not up. Important to note that even Everytown admits that the number of home-built guns that have been seized, or at least traced, over the last 4 years, they seem to be more popular in cities with very restrictive gun laws, like New York City. Just saying. Now, of course, for Everytown, that's an excuse to say, well, we got to go after the code that's used to print gun parts. We have to put pressure on the makers of 3D printers to outlaw the use of their products to help build firearms, even though home-built firearms, long a part of our national tradition of gun ownership, the fact that it is easier to build one today than it was back in 1791 does not change the fact that home-built firearms are in fact protected by the Second Amendment, despite attempts by states like New York and California to criminalize the making of those firearms. Anyway, that's just one part of Everytown's report. They analyzed data, they say, obtained from local police departments on the characteristics of nearly 350,000 guns used in crimes in more than 50 U.S. cities from 2020 to 2024, including where the weapons came from and how those origins have changed over time. And here's the thing. These 350,000 firearms that were traced, not all of them are used in crime. In fact, if you look at ATF trace data for individual states, typically the number one reason to trace a firearm is firearm under investigation. If that's not the most common reason, it is up there. I'm looking at Virginia, for example. This is 2023. Of the categories reported on firearm traces with a Virginia recovery, 4,184 weapon offense. Now, we don't know what that is. That's an awfully generic term, right? But it doesn't necessarily imply that the firearm is used in a violent crime. This could be a possessory offense. Second most popular reason for tracing a firearm, firearm under investigation. Third most common reason, possession of a firearm. Fourth most common reason, found firearm. Fifth most common reason, carrying a concealed weapon. Now, none of those top five categories necessarily mean that a gun was used in a crime, at least a violent crime, right? Compared to the 3,297 cases in Virginia where a firearm was traced because it was under investigation, you had 570 firearms that were traced as a result of dangerous drugs. You had 396 that were traced as a result of a homicide, 335 traced as a result of a suicide, 319 traced in connection to an aggravated assault, 239 traced in connection to property crimes. But again, the vast majority of the firearms that were traced were not necessarily related to, connected to, in any way, a violent crime. Part of the problem is the ATF classifies trace firearms as crime guns, which is a misnomer that I would love to see corrected under the Trump administration. Just call them traced firearms because that's what they are. But again, that phrasing benefits the gun control lobby. It benefits groups like Everytown who want to, again, claim that all of these guns that were traced were, in fact, used in violent offenses. Now, NPR spoke with David Pacino, who's the legal director at Giffords Law Center to Prevent Gun Violence. He was not involved in the study, but they talked to him for some reason. And you know, we see the narrative advanced here, even though Pacino's not connected to Everytown. He's more than happy to buttress their flawed study. He says that the public deserves to know this. Policymakers deserve to know this. Activists deserve to know this. And people in communities that are harmed by gun violence deserve to know this information. I would say they also deserve to know that, again, not every one of these guns that's traced is a gun that's been used in a crime. That's pretty basic information that they should know. But that was left out entirely of Everytown's report, left out entirely of NPR's report on Everytown's report, and I imagine it's going to be left out of a lot of the media coverage of Everytown's so-called study. Getting back to the 3D printed firearms, as I said, they identified 20 cities with 5 years of data on the recovery of 3D printed firearms. In 2020, these 20 cities recovered a total of 32 3D printed firearms. They say, quote, at crime scenes, but again, we know that's not the case. In 2024, the number recovered climbed to 325. That is a 1,000% increase, but it's still a small fraction of the number of firearms that actually are used in violent crimes. That is not stopping gun control advocates, however, from demanding action be taken. As NPR reports, gun control advocates say there are strategies to regulate the printing of these firearms, not regulate, prohibit. Companies that make 3D printers could develop algorithms to block the printing of firearms, for instance, NPR writes, or states could make it illegal to publish blueprints for 3D printing a gun. Again, that's not regulating the printing of gun parts. That is prohibiting it outright. Pacino says, I think what makes sense is to explore all of the strategies right now, to have every approach and to push it forward, because this is such a new area and it's such a concerning threat. Is it really? Is it really? And again, I would say the threat is to our First Amendment rights, because code is speech. And this would not be the first attempt to regulate or even criminalize speech connected to our right to keep and bear arms. You know, we were talking just yesterday about California's law that made it illegal to market a firearm in a manner that might be attractive to a minor, a law that was struck down as a violation of the First Amendment by the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals. Yes, the Ninth Circuit actually found fault with that law. This is the same thing. Code is speech. And Pacino might not like the fact that people are using code to print gun parts, to assemble firearms, but it doesn't change the fact that this is still a activity that's protected not only by the Second Amendment, but by the First Amendment as well. You know, books like The Anarchist Cookbook, which have recipes on how to make explosives, you can buy that at Amazon. You might not be able to find it in your local bookstore. Heck, you might not even have a local bookstore anymore. But that is protected by the First Amendment. If that is protected by the First Amendment, then clearly lines of code that help somebody produce an item that is also protected under the U.S. Constitution would be constitutionally protected speech. But it is speech that, again, the gun control lobby wants to prohibit. The Everytown Report also looked at which manufacturers' guns were found at crime scenes. And they say, although the U.S. has more than 20,000 firearm manufacturers, just four companies, Glock, Taurus, Smith & Wesson, and Ruger, accounted for more than half of the firearms recovered at crime scenes across the country last year. Now, again, notice how they continually say, recovered at crime scenes, recovered at crime scenes, recovered at crime scenes. How about we say that the most popular firearms in the country were also the most commonly traced firearms? Now, does that come as a surprise to anybody? Shouldn't. Nick Cipollina, Senior Vice President of Law and Policy at Everytown, say that manufacturers bear responsibility for this. He says there's a correlation between the size of market share and the number of recoveries. It only goes to the point that these companies are gaining market share by selling guns that are ending up in crimes and then washing their hands of those crimes. The breadcrumbs go right back to the manufacturers. Well, again, not every gun that's traced is used in a crime. Not every gun that's used in a crime is traced, right? But how is this the responsibility of gun makers any more than it's the responsibility of Ford or Chevy that those are among the most common car makers connected to DUIs, right? Or even you could say, InBev or some of the other big alcoholic beverage companies, you know, that, studies show that 30% of DUI offenses involved, you know, this particular brand of beer, this particular brand of spirits. Does that mean that that company is responsible for the actions of the drunk driver? No. So why would it be any different when it comes to gun makers being responsible for the actions of criminals? And again, if it's not surprising that the most popular firearms in the country are also those that are most commonly traced, that is not indicative of any bad action on the part of these gun companies. Of course, again, if you're Everytown, right, you're trying to demonize these companies. That's their whole shtick, right? That gun makers, we saw this in the lawsuit that the government of Mexico filed against many gun makers here in the United States, right? That they were willfully aiding and abetting cartel violence because they knew that some guns that they made were going to end up south of the border, used in crimes, and therefore they bore some responsibility, some direct culpability in cartel violence. Now, if that theory is true, then what's the only way to avoid responsibility or culpability? To not produce firearms, right? If you are aware that some portion of your legally produced and legally sold products are going to end up in the hands of criminals, and that means that you're responsible, again, under Everytown's theory, then what other way would there be to avoid culpability except to not produce those products? Again, there is, in Everytown's worldview, there is no responsibility placed on the individual who actually commits these violent crimes, right? It's all the fault of the gun maker, maybe the gun seller, maybe the gun distributor, Second Amendment advocates, right? But not the trigger puller. No, they're just, you know, misunderstood waifs, I guess, right? Driven to their crimes because of the nefarious marketing of the gun lobby. Yeah. Everytown says it found that half of nearly 2 million guns traced by the ATF between 2019 to 2023 were legally purchased, but ended up at a crime scene within 3 years. Which they say is generally considered an indicator that the gun was purchased in order to be trafficked and used for criminal activity. Now, again, we don't know what the circumstances were for these traces. But going back to what I said earlier, typically the most common reason for a firearms trace is not anything that's connected to a violent crime. I mentioned Virginia earlier. Let's take a look at New Jersey, for example. State with a lot of gun control laws, right? 2023, again, top categories reported on firearm traces with a New Jersey recovery. Possession of weapon, number one reason. 1,897 traces conducted for that reason. Second most common reason, found firearm. 1,163. The third most common reason in New Jersey, weapon offense, again, that very vague term, 310 firearms traced because of a weapons offense. And the number of firearms with a recovery of less than 3 years. Oh, boy, let's see. I got to do some math here. Let's say about 1,200 firearms with a recovery of less than 3 years, about 1,900 firearms with a recovery of time to sale of, you know, 3 years or more. That's a state, again, with very restrictive gun control laws. And again, nearly half of those guns that were traced were sold less than 3 years prior. But again, the number one reason for those traces was simply possession of a firearm. So if you legally possess a gun in your home, police are called out for some reason, they recover a firearm. Maybe you're the victim of a crime, but a firearm's there on the scene. They take that firearm. They trace it to make sure that you are the lawful owner. Is that a crime gun? You're never charged. You're never even accused of a crime. Is that a crime gun? I mean, again, under the ATF's terminology, yes. Is it evidence of gun trafficking? Absolutely not. We can look at Illinois, too. Here's Illinois 2023. Top category for firearm traces with an Illinois recovery. Firearm under investigation. 11,000 traces in Illinois for firearm under investigation. About 4,400 for that vague weapons offense. Another 3,000 for possession of a weapon. Another 1,500 or so for found firearm. Just 163 for robbery, by the way. 288 for aggravated assault. 328 for homicide. Those are actual violent crimes, right? The number of guns traced in Illinois that had been sold less than 3 years prior. You're looking at about, let's see, 31, 42, 53, about 6,000 firearms. Another 8,500 were traced that had been sold more than 3 years ago. So it doesn't matter if a state has restrictive gun control laws or not. In every state, yeah, almost half of the firearms that are recovered have been sold less than 3 years prior. What might account for that? Oh, I don't know. Could it be the record level of gun sales we saw in 2020, 2021, and 2022? Might that have something to do with it? The fact that more people bought guns? So there were more recently purchased firearms to trace? That to me seems like the simplest explanation. But of course, every town doesn't even bother trying to make that. They don't even bother trying to, offer an explanation for why that might be the case. Right. They also use this as a push for, of course, more gun control laws, not just aimed at manufacturers, but aimed at gun owners as well. Right. This NPR report, another way legally purchased guns end up being used in crimes is through theft. And Bill Brooks, a retired police chief from Norwood, Massachusetts, chair of the Firearms Committee of the International Association of Chiefs of Police, which, by the way, is very anti-gun, funded by the Joyce Foundation, says gun owners have a role to play in combating the problem. He said, we know that there are more firearms than there are people in the United States. So what if everybody who owned a firearm kept it locked up? What would happen to the number of suicides by family members, accidental discharges among children, people getting a parent's firearm and then going somewhere and doing a mass shooting or a homicide? Well, I'm a big believer in responsible gun ownership. I don't believe that you should have your firearms available for anybody to grab. If you keep a gun in your car, I definitely think that you should keep it stored where it's not visible. I think it's a good idea to lock it up. I think it's an even better idea not to leave your gun in the car. But, we live in a country where there are plenty of gun-free zones where you might be forced to leave your firearm behind unless you want to commit a crime by carrying into a gun-free zone. More importantly, I don't believe in storage mandates because those storage mandates are often written in a way that makes it virtually impossible to use a firearm in self-defense, even in the home. When you've got laws that require firearms to be kept locked at all times, ammunition stored separately, unless it's being carried on your person, you are essentially telling people that the only way they can really defend themselves in their home is if they've got their gun on them at all times. And, some people that might not be a big deal. For other people, a lot of people might be an imposition. I'll be honest with you, I don't shower with a gun on me. I don't. Don't even brush my teeth with a gun on me, usually. I'm still in my PJs. But that is exactly what the gun control lobby wants, right? Again, unless it is strapped to your hip, maybe carried on your ankle, wherever you normally carry it. Unless it's there, it should be locked up, inaccessible for not only strangers, not only burglars or juveniles, but for you. In case you need that firearm in self-defense, run to your safe, fumble with the code, grab the gun, get the ammunition, right, which has to be stored separately in many states, load that firearm. Oh, hang on, bad guy, hang on, just another couple of seconds, right? Again, these laws are not written in a way that would allow for lawful gun owners to use their firearms in self-defense. They are written in a way to make it as difficult as possible, even for the legal gun owner, to access that firearm when that gun is needed. So again, you're going to hear a lot about this report. I think simply the timing of this, which I believe is entirely intentional. This report was originally released last year, but they've updated it, I suspect, in light of the high-profile shootings in Australia and at Brown University. But it really doesn't tell us anything at all other than the number of guns that were traced in these particular cities, right, which is already publicly available data. You can go to the ATF website. You can find trace data for all 50 states. And it's what the report doesn't say. It's what the report leaves out. I think that's really important because it is, I believe, intentionally designed to give a false impression, A, about the number of crimes involving firearms, but more importantly, it is designed to give the false impression that the firearms industry is, again, knowingly and willfully aiding and abetting violent criminals. Because if they can leave that impression with an uninformed public, then they've got a villain, right? If you can demonize the firearms industry, as Joe Biden did, Joe Biden declared the firearms industry was his enemy when he was running for president. Well, then you don't necessarily need to pass gun laws that are directed solely at gun owners, right? You can pass laws that, on the surface, are targeting these gun makers. You don't have that trickle-down effect on making it harder, more expensive, and ultimately impossible to legally exercise your Second Amendment rights. Hopefully, now we're all a little bit more informed about not only Everytown's intentions, which I think were pretty clear, but again, about the deceptive use of statistics and what they don't want you to know about ATF trace data. All right, on to today's Armed Citizen story, our good deed of the day, and our recidivist report. We will start there with a story from CWB Chicago. Man wearing ankle monitor attacked three women days after a judge refused to detain him. Yeah. Second day in a row, we've actually had a recidivist report from the state of Illinois. Marlon Miller was in a Cook County courtroom last Friday. He was accused of randomly attacking three women in the loop at a time when he was supposed to be confined to his home on electronic monitoring. Why was he on electronic monitoring? Because he was accused of randomly attacking four other women in the loop. And as CWB Chicago's Tim Heckey reports, the alleged attacks occurred just days after a judge refused to keep him in jail, despite another warning from another judge that the 40-year-old had a, quote, very violent history. Despite a prosecutorial request to keep Miller in jail, and despite the fact that there is a growing criticism of Cook County's electronic monitoring failures following the attack on the CTA train in which a woman was set on fire by somebody who was on electronic monitoring. As Heckey reports, Miller first appeared in CWB Chicago's reporting 7 years ago, 2018, when he broke a man's jaw in two places during another random unprovoked attack. He got mental health probation and a 180-day jail term for that case. But the violence has continued. On March 8th of this year, he got a 3-day sentence for misdemeanor battery after hitting a woman in the face. On May 20th, he got a 10-day sentence for misdemeanor battery after punching a woman in the head. That same month, he got a 75-day sentence for punching a woman multiple times. This fall, he started racking up more cases, all while under electronic monitoring. October the 10th, Chicago police arrested him on misdemeanor reckless conduct charge. Witness told officers that he saw Miller punch two women in their faces and then run away and push another woman to the ground. That witness actually followed Miller until officers arrived, but a judge released him the next day. Following month, November 15th, he was arrested inside a Dunkin' after a 22-year-old woman said he slapped her across the face. Prosecutors charged him with misdemeanor battery. The offense not detainable under Illinois law, so Cook County Judge Susanna Ortiz ordered him onto electronic monitoring administered by the Cook County Chief Judge's Office. Miller then failed to appear in court 5 days later, but the victim also failed to show up in court, and so prosecutors dropped that case altogether. 5 days after that, November 25th, 30-year-old woman told police that Miller struck her in the face with a potbelly cup filled with a milkshake. Officers interviewed the woman, noted she could not fully open her right eye afterwards. The officer's report notes that Miller was wearing an electronic monitor on his left ankle at the time. Once again, the charge of misdemeanor battery. The judge, in this case, ordered him to continue on electronic monitoring, writing that Miller has a, quote, very violent history and a random violent new charge. Also ordered him detained, though, for violating pretrial release terms in the October reckless conduct case. But apparently he was released again. December 1st, they asked Judge Peter Gonzalez to detain Miller in custody due to the escalating number of random attacks and his repeated violations. But the judge refused to detain Miller and sent him home once again on an ankle monitor. And then on December the 10th, he allegedly carried out three more unprovoked attacks in the loop while he was supposed to be confined to his home. 50-year-old woman was allegedly punched in the face. 49-year-old woman allegedly punched in the face at nearly the exact same time and same spot. And a 62-year-old woman reported that Miller struck her in the face as well, causing bruising to her nose and face. Now he has been charged with three counts of aggravated battery in a public place. He has been ordered detained on these latest charges for who knows, for how long, who knows. But again, I mean, you've just got a repeated history of the same type of assault. And the judicial system in Cook County, Illinois, shrugs its collective shoulders. Heckey with CWB Chicago also reports that The chief judge's office in Cook County routinely allows people on electronic monitoring to accumulate extensive violations of their house arrest provisions without any consequence. The office has no enforcement mechanism. It just keeps a list of violations that they then pass along to the defendant's judge at a future court date. So you can violate the terms of your electronic monitoring and face no consequences whatsoever. CWB Chicago recently reported that a man who's been charged with shooting another man on the red line, the gun-free red line, also subject to electronic monitoring and violating the terms of that monitoring, apparently. You know, Illinois has a lot of problems. Chicago has a lot of problems. Cook County has a lot of problems, including these gun-free zones that make it impossible for people to lawfully protect themselves in places like public transportation. But again, these soft-on-crime policies are just, and they're making things worse. Not just for the victims of these violent offenders, but for everybody, right? Because you don't know who the next victim is going to be. But there are an awful lot of people in Chicago who are running around with ankle monitors who frankly should be behind bars. And the state of Illinois has made it very difficult to actually ensure that these threats to public safety can be confined to a jail cell until they are convicted in court. All right, on to today's armed citizen story from Louisiana, where the Alexandria police say the man was injured in a self-defense shooting. Don't have a ton of information about this. It happened December 15th, about 4:20 in the afternoon. Alexandria police responded to a shooting call, and they found that a guy named Avery Lewis, 31 years old, had been shot after he jumped into a parked delivery truck in what they described as a threatening manner. The driver of that delivery truck, I'm not going to name him since he's not been charged with a crime, shot him in self-defense. The driver then immediately called police. Avery Lewis described as moderately injured, taken to a hospital. The Alexandria police say that they believe this is connected to a home invasion back in November, which was investigated by the Rapides Parish Sheriff's Office. The resident, who is the delivery driver, shot and killed the intruder, identified as Devontae Thomas. Investigators learned that Avery Lewis and Thomas knew each other, and they believe that Avery Lewis may have been trying to retaliate against the delivery driver by hopping into his truck in a, quote, threatening manner, was shot before he had a chance to carry out that attack. Investigators say they believe this is an isolated incident between the two individuals. The case investigation, I guess, remains ongoing, but at this point, again, Alexandria police say they believe this to be a case of self-defense. They haven't said, by the way, whether the delivery driver knew the home invader, Devontae Thomas, but, you know, this is one of the first armed citizen stories that I can recall where the armed citizen acted in self-defense like twice within basically a 6-week period of time, and that his first act of self-defense led directly, according to police anyway, to the second act of self-defense, that he was actually targeted for retaliation because he protected himself against a home invader the month prior. So we'll keep our eyes on this story, but again, at this point, the delivery driver not facing any charges. I'm not naming him because he's the victim of a crime, not the suspect of a crime, but Avery Lewis going to be facing some pretty serious charges, I believe, in connection with this attack. We will keep our eyes open for any more details on this unusual story out of Alexandria, Louisiana. And finally today, our good deed of the day, in the right place, at the right time, willing able to do the right thing. A couple of employees of the Ace Hardware store in Redwood City, California, who helped rescue a woman from a burning car after she rammed in to the hardware store. This was a Monday night. One of the employees who did not want to have his identity released said that we heard the car go off. He said he was inside the store at the checkout lane, narrowly missed being hit. One individual said, I was trying to pay attention to my kids. I know they were there and they were walking in. I was at the first register and I walked away too. He said, I stood a foot away. He said, I think it was just God. God looks out for you. So after the woman ran into that car, ran into the store, rather, A worker pulled the driver from that burning vehicle, assisted by a co-worker, a 16-year-old Ricky Para, who said that she was kind of going through her belongings in shock. She didn't get out of the vehicle. My coworker had to go and grab her out of the vehicle. The unidentified worker who managed to extricate her from the car said, I think she was in shock. I just opened the door and I had to get her because the car's in flames already. It ultimately became a 2-alarm fire. The initial attempts to douse the flames from the car failed, so firefighters had their work cut out for them. Glendon Chan, a battalion chief for the Redwood City Fire Department, says the area where they where the woman drove into is where they have butane and some of the lighter accessories. And some of those actually caught on fire as well. Took firefighters about 20 minutes to extinguish the blaze. Thankfully, no injuries. The structure is still sound. A regular shopper at the hardware store says it's been a great asset to the neighborhood, and I'm very, very sorry it happened to them. There was pretty severe damage to the interior of the building, and some surrounding stores in the strip mall sustained water and smoke damage that are temporarily closed. But again, no loss of life, thankfully. Ricky Para praised his unidentified coworker, said, I see him as a hero because he's the only one who stepped up and really got in there and got her out of there. Unfortunately, right now, Para and that coworker and all of the other workers at the Ace Hardware store are off the clock because the store is closed for some time as the repairs are made. As to what led to this crash, Redwood City police investigators say that it looks like this was an elderly driver who got confused, mistook the gas pedal for the brake pedal, and that's why the car rammed into that store. No charges have been filed. And again, thankfully, no serious injuries reported because of the quick thinking and the fast actions of that unidentified employee of the Ace Hardware store and his coworker, Ricky Para. In the right place, I guess, in the right place, at the right time, certainly, and willing and able to do the right thing. All right, that is going to do it for this edition of Bearing Arms, Cam & Company, and I do want to thank you for being a part of the program, as always. I am looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. We're going to be doing something a little bit different. You know, a lot of times, I'd say the vast majority of our programming here at Bearing Arms, Cam & Company, we're talking about Second Amendment politics, right? But I ran across a story, this was last week, about U.S. Army Reserve Lieutenant Colonel Lauren Sharpless, who just won the 40-plus national title at the Tactical Games National Championship. Well, she won the championship last year in her category. She finished second this year. And she's got a really interesting story. And you know, we're getting to that time of year. People are making New Year's resolutions. One of my resolutions is to, lose some of the flab and get in better shape in 2026. So I'm doing this partly to motivate myself, but again, partly because I think Lieutenant Colonel Sharpless really does have an interesting story to tell. So we're going to be talking with the Lieutenant Colonel Lauren Sharpless on, tomorrow's Bearing Arms, Cam & Company. I'm really looking forward to it. And then again, next week, looking forward to hosting Assistant Attorney General Harmeet Dhillon. Hopefully that'll be either Monday or Tuesday, but we'll let you know. And again, in the meantime, between now and then, make sure you're checking out BearingArms.com. We're keeping you up to date on all the latest Second Amendment news and information from all across the nation, including the DOJ's new lawsuit against the U.S. Virgin Islands government over infringing on the Second Amendment rights of the residents of the Virgin Islands. We've got more news, armed citizen stories, legislative updates as well. Be sure to check it out. If you like what you see, I'd also encourage you to become a VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum member. Just use the promo code FIGHT when you go to BearingArms.com/subscribe. You get 60% off your VIP, VIP Gold or VIP Platinum membership. No matter what tier of support you choose, we certainly thank you for it. And I'm looking forward to seeing you back here again tomorrow. Until then, be well. Be safe. And be free.